evening, you know, we've got quite a few skeptics who join us for the evenings, and it's more of a, you know, quick Q&A type of environment. So, that's what we do. How about you guys, Dennis? Where do you church in Cambridge?
We go to a church called Eden Chapel, which is a Baptist church. Okay. It's quite a, by British standards, a fairly large church. And it's caters for a lot of students. So we have probably about 100 students come along every Sunday, something like that. And yeah, so it's mostly pretty young professionals, big high turnover, typical Cambridge people going through all the time, here for 3 years, PhD, postdoc, and then they're moving on. So about a few hundred people there on Sunday morning under usual circumstances. And we have been meeting by Zoom for 2 months now. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And Bob, where does he go?
Bob goes to an Anglican church. Little Shelford is a village right on the edge of Cambridge. It's just outside Cambridge. And so he's active there. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're going to start. Okay. I see a few people are coming in, but let me just introduce Dennis to the rest of you guys before I get started. So I need to exit full screen here for a second. So who is Dennis Alexander, apart from the guy in the left-hand corner of your Zoom screen? Dr. Alexander, I'm just going to read his bio from one of the many websites where I found it. He is the Emeritus Director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion at St. Edmund's College at Cambridge, where he's also a fellow. He was previously chairman of the Molecular Immunology Program and head of the Laboratory of Lymphocyte Signaling and Development at the Babram Institute, Cambridge, which, Dennis, is just deliberately making it difficult for me to know what you do, I think. Prior to that, Dr. Alexander was at the Imperial Cancer Research Laboratories in London and spent 15 years developing university departments and laboratories overseas. Most recently, he was Associate Professor of Biochemistry in the Medical Faculty of the American University of Beirut in Lebanon. He's got some fascinating stories there. He was caught up in the Civil War. In a case where he helped to establish the National Unit of Human Genetics. Dr. Alexander was initially an open scholar at Oxford, reading biochemistry before obtaining a PhD in neurochemistry at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. And then I'm going to finish soon because I know we're going to want to ask questions and not just read this CV that is as long as the Old Testament. Dr. Alexander writes lectures and broadcasts widely in the field of science and religion. Since 1992, he has been the editor of the journal Science and Christian Belief and currently serves on the National Committee of Christians and Science and as a member of the International Society for Science and Religion. He's written many books. Probably the one that I'm most interested in is a book that he... Well, first of all, I'm reading this from the Gifford Lecture website. So he delivered the Gifford Lectures, which is probably some of the more famous lectures that you can deliver within natural theology at Scottish universities. So he delivered a lecture there entitled Genes, Determinism, and God. And those lectures will now be published by Cambridge University Press. And Dr. Alexander promised me that it's going to be a popular level book, which I highly, highly doubt. On that topic and by that publisher, I doubt whether that's going to be a popular level book. But in any case, Dr. Alexander, it is such a privilege for us to have you. Thank you again for making the time to speak to us SAFFers.
Chip in and just say good to be here. But also, by the way, the Gifford Lectures book came out in 2017.
Oh, okay.
It came out several years ago, Genes, Determinism, and God, just to clarify that point. And the popular version is coming out later this year, and that's going to be called Are We Slaves to Our Genes?
Thank you.
Just to clarify that point. Right.
Okay. Good. Thanks. So just to clarify to the rest of you guys, how we're going to do this evening is, I'm just gonna ask a few questions to start us off with, and then after that, you guys can join in and ask your questions. I'm going to try and not keep us much longer than an hour, and then let's see what we can fit in the hour that we have. So that's the format. I think the first question that I want to get cracking with, Dennis, is the whole question of free will. So obviously you've written a book about this. You think about this on many levels. But I know on a very popular level in South Africa, somebody that's popular here is an American guy called Sam Harris. And I'm not sure how well he is known or received in the scientific community, but on a very popular level, he is popular in South Africa. And he seems to think that free will is very is an illusion. And he's quite passionate about the idea that we do not have free will. And this has been picked up by I guess, a few other thinkers. But I guess my first question would be this. Why is it so important for many people to argue that there isn't free will? What are some of the philosophical implications that hangs on that question? Before I ask you whether you think we are just slaves to our genes, maybe just help me understand why is this such an important topic for many?
Yes, I think it goes very fundamentally down to the way our societies are structured. Particularly thinking about legal responsibility. Generally, free will is tied in with intentional actions for which we are morally responsible. And so clearly, if we do remove that, then we are removing a very significant function for it in terms of justice, in terms of whether we can blame people for their actions or not, or whether we just say, well, they're poor, sick people, so we can't really blame them. It also has, of course, very big implications for our personal relationships. So if I love somebody and it's just purely programmed that I should do that, I don't really have any choice about the matter, then any real deep sense of love, I guess, goes out of the window, doesn't it? So, and of course, speaking then as a Christian also, I'd have to say, well, you know, if I'm a Christian, it was all programmed anyway, so why bother? You know, in other words, if I had to be that way, then it doesn't seem to me a very significant type of relationship that I have with God if I had no choice, a real choice in the matter. And so on, we could go on and on about that, you know. So I think it's a very basic facet, very basic characteristic of stable societies, actually. And if you lose it, then, you know, you're going to lose something, actually. I just want to say one more point about it, actually. I mean, people have done sociological studies on free will in different, many, many different cultures around the world. Basically, to ask the question, do all cultures that we can study actually experience this, have this profound sense of up-to-usness, the sense that somehow I'm responsible for my actions? And the answer so far is yes. And people have looked at many, 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 many different societies with different languages and try to probe into this. And there's some interesting papers actually on that question. And I think, so it seems to be a very profound general characteristic of humanity, of being human. And personally, as a biologist, I just see it as basic as having, for most of us, having two arms and two legs. I know that doesn't apply to everybody, but it's just something about Homo sapiens, about humanity, that we do have this particular characteristic, which is very deep and profound in our personas now. That by itself doesn't mean to say that it has ontological reality, but, you know, I think that's where the discussion has to start.
Okay. So moving on then, Dennis, why do you think we are not just slaves to our genes?
Well, as far as the genetics is concerned, of course, one has to think in terms of the neurosciences or genetics, but let's stick with the genetics. I mean, certainly the whole field of behavioral genetics tells us that the genetic variants that make us all unique do have an influence upon our behaviors, depending on what they are. And this is measured by what people in the field call heritability, which needs a careful definition, okay? It's not inheritance. Heritability is the proportion of variation that you see in a given population with regard to a particular behavior trait, we call it, in biology, that can be ascribed to the variation in the genes in that population. Okay, so in other words, it's saying that genetic variants have something to do with it. On the whole, on average, that's very far away from determinism. That doesn't really undermine free will. However, there are certain genetic, often genetic pathologies, where free will is definitely undermined and subverted. So I think part of the problem in the free will discussion is people tend to think of it as either yes, you have it, or no, you don't. I would see it more like a spectrum. So on a lovely spring day, you know, when you don't have coronavirus around and you're feeling as free as a bird and you feel that you can make decisions the way you want, okay, so that's up one end of the spectrum. But clearly, up right up the other end of the spectrum, there is determinism. Clearly, there is some genetic determinism. And I would say normally that arises out of genetic pathology, where there are some clear genetically mutated, you know, cause diseases, which result in individuals who very sadly have very much reduced free will or even absent altogether. And that's where you get into the field of psychiatric genetics, and where you have psychiatrists pulled into court cases to answer questions about the person's responsibility, and so forth and so on. So I see it as a spectrum, and I think that's a helpful way of looking at it.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I guess if I just push a little bit further, here's a question actually from Louise Mobile. So we should not think of free will in terms of something like a Kantian category. Does that make sense? I don't want to assume that you're a philosopher.
Right. Well, I'm not a professional philosopher, but I sort of know where that's coming from, I think. Yeah. So I would see, I myself would call free, if you want to talk a philosophical language, I would myself call free will an ontological reality that we possess, but it has deep biological roots. Okay. So I'm a biologist, so I suppose I see things generally more through the eyes of a biologist in that way. And so I start out with our own experiences, living conscious human beings and what we experience in our daily lives, and this very profound sense of up-to-usness that we all mostly experience most of the time. And then I say, well, do we, you know, okay, so in science, is the scientific data that we can put forward which would count against that idea, and like Sam Harris then say, well, actually, it's an illusion. You know, it's not something that we could really take seriously because it's undermined some way by our knowledge of the brain or by our knowledge of genetics or whatever it might be. Okay, and so that's sort of where I come from. So, yeah, is it a Kantian category? Yes, I think so. I would see it as an ontological reality. It's something that's profoundly deep and real, but it has deep biological roots, and therefore when we look at our dogs and cats and horses and whatever it is, I'm sure we can see that animals have some consciousness, they have some sense, they make choices all the time, we see them doing that, but by inference we think to ourselves, well, clearly they're not the same as when humans are making choices. We don't count them as morally responsible for what they're doing. When a dog bites somebody very badly or even kills a baby, which happens from time to time, we don't take the dog to court. Okay, so it's very profound, I think, this sense of moral responsibility that's wrapped up in our sense of free will.
Mm. So if you guys want to revisit some of the questions on free will, we can do that in a bit. I think for now, I just want to give a snapshot of some of the questions, and we can get back to maybe sticky points that, or if people were triggered by something, then we can just get back to that a little bit later. But on the other part of the spectrum, Dr. Alexander, it's quite interesting to see that you've got this conversation that says that we do not have free will. We are just, they reduce everything to these natural processes. And then on the other hand, you have, when it comes to gender identity, for example, this new wave of thinking that says that it's all performative. There's no biological or naturalistic or natural necessity in our gender, and it's just something that we put on. So I'm thinking of a lady who also actually presented at the Gifford Lectures, called Judith Butler, who's now a famous critical thinker when it comes to gender. And for her, the whole idea of gender is just performative. So as a biologist, and then I know I'm switching gears between various topics, but what do you make of it? Gender, if I ask you this question, is gender divine or human? Is there something biological, or is it just biological, or is it something that is constructed?
Right. So I'll just come to that I will come to that in just one second. But just before we totally leave free will, okay, I just want to hold up this book, which is by a professional philosopher. I want to give it a plug, actually. It's Christian List. He's professor of philosophy at London School of Economics. And the title of the book, in case you can't see it, is Why Free Will is Real. Why Free Will is Real. We ask about ontological reality. It's published by Harvard University Press. It came out last year. And I love it because he expresses in the words of a professional philosopher what I believe. Okay, so very, very closely. And I just wanted to flag that up, actually, so before we move on to the question of gender.
Thanks, Dennis. It appears that other people also do not want to leave the question of free will yet. So Torsten is asking this question, can there be any free will without supernature?
Can there be any free will without supernature? Wow. Again, that raises a big question about what one really believes by supernature. Okay, so as a Christian, I believe in God as creator, as the author of everything that exists. So do I believe in a supernatural entity? Yeah, I believe in a God who is the author of all that exists. Okay, so God upholds and creates and sustains everything that's in existence, which is what makes science possible. Otherwise, there would be no reproducibility of the properties of matter. We would have no laws of science, and science would not be possible, and we wouldn't be here. So I just think the whole gnomic regularity of the universe that we observe as scientists has a profound sense of depth in God as the author of existence. Okay, so if you want to take that as supernature, well, then all that we observe and see as scientists is an expression of that supernature worked out in material things, in energy things, in our own beings and so forth. Yes, in that sense, of course, I believe that our whole beings as human beings, as the whole created order, has its source in God as creator. Now, I don't think that's what the questioner was getting at, okay? I suspect, okay? But I'm just putting that perspective, first of all, because I think it's important in terms of what do we really understand by supernature, what do we really understand by supernatural. If the question is saying, is somehow free will some special input of God, as it were, imparting free will upon creatures in a way that bypasses their biology in some way or bypasses their own humanity, in some way, then I would say no. I don't go there. No, I just think, atheists myself. I know a lot of atheists who believe in free will. I know a lot of other people of different faiths who believe in free will. I don't think it's a faith issue myself. I think, you know, to me, free will is just, as I was mentioning earlier, it's just a profound property that all humanity has, whether they like it or not. I mean, the fact that they say like some terrorists, they really don't believe in it and so forth, but then they practice it every day. You can't avoid it. And I would want to say, if you really don't believe, I mean, really, really don't believe in free will, you should definitely see a psychiatrist. I'm quite serious about that, by the way. Somebody who really doesn't see themselves as morally responsible could be a real danger to themselves, and probably a danger to other people. And clearly, you know, there are psychopaths and people who really don't have a deep experience of free will in the way that the rest of the population does. And we should be wary about that. So, yeah, so I think that, it's just a property of people.
Yeah, I don't know much about even the philosophical, and definitely nothing about the biological things that that you are stressing, Dennis, but I do find it peculiar that some people are very excited about the prospect of not having free will, that it's something that they push. And I'm not quite sure I understand the ideological reasoning behind it. What is it that excites them about this, the implications of that? But it seems like we're not moving on to my second question. So Pete Hein asks the question, what exactly is the biological foundation for the existence of free will?
Oh, the biological foundation. Oh, I see. Well, that comes obviously to how one relates brain and mind, and that's a huge discussion that's been going on for many hundreds of years, which we probably won't resolve in the next 5 minutes, but I can sort of give you my nutshell view on that. So I would see mind as an emergent phenomena from brain. Emergence then means simply that you have weak emergence and you have strong emergence. Weak emergence is something fairly trivial, but let's say the wetness of water, we know that water has a structure of H2O, but that doesn't tell you anything about its wetness. Okay, so water has an emergent property of wetness when it comes into contact with people like ourselves who can describe it as wet. So that's a sort of form of weak emergence that's all over the place. Strong emergence is a little bit different. It's where there is really no way that you can derive a mind simply by looking at brain as a neuroscientist. You just came to brain for the first time as a neuroscientist, which is, of course, impossible. But let's do a thought experiment. There is no way that you could derive mind from that. Okay, in other words, you cannot, as it were. So mind is a distinct property, but it's an emergent property. And in the philosophical language, it's spoken of as being supervenient upon functioning of the brain. Supervenient means dependent upon. It's ultimately dependent upon that. But its status is so different that we use a different language for it. We use the I language for mind. Whereas for your brain, if I'm looking at your brain through my scanner as a neuroscientist, I would use the language of it. So we have an it language and we have an I language. And of course, we know that they're closely related, but we don't know how they translate together. And so moving on from that, we'd want to say muddling up, as Sam Harris, I think, is in a muddle on this point, frankly. So he's muddling up, you know, the properties of the brain and trying to say, well, because they behave in a gnomically regular way, because they behave in a way that we can understand as scientists and so forth. Therefore, this in itself somehow subverts and undermines the reality of free will. Okay, so I think there are two points there which are mistaken. One is it's sort of a category error. And Christian List, by the way, the guy I just mentioned, the author I just mentioned, is very good on this. But it's simply a category error to try and start talking about free will, you know, in the language of synaptic connections and the biochemistry of the brain. You know, it's a different category. If you want to talk about things sensibly, you need to talk about categories that make sense within that context. Because the free will then belongs to the I language. It belongs to that concept of mind. And it's not independent of brain, but it's supervenient upon brain. It's a different category. And if we want to have a sensible discussion, I think then we have to talk about, we have to use the language of mind and philosophy in talking about free will. Okay. So that's sort of part of the preliminary clearing of the decks in a way of having a discussion about it, you know. But the second point I make to Sam Harris is simply, well, I take the opposite view from him. I say, well, if we don't have an orderly brain, if the brain was not functioning properly, then we definitely would not have free will. Okay. Our free will is absolutely dependent upon, you know, the proper functioning of the brain, biologically speaking. And of course, that's where psychiatry comes up. And, you know, if you have a major depression, then free will certainly declines. I mean, people do crazy things when they've got a major depression. They would never normally do if they didn't have that. And, you know, that's a function of the brain. The brain goes into shutdown. It goes into this deep sense of gloom and dark clouds come over the horizon. And it's a horrible thing to have. And so I think that just gives us an illustration of the way that brain and mind are very tightly regulated together. And you can't really, you know, so mind supervenes upon the brain. I just have to use the language of philosophy to express that point.
Okay. Louise has a question, but Louise is a friend of mine, so she'll forgive me if I just skip that question because I just want to get to some other questions. And I'm worried when philosophers get involved, then I promise people this is going to be a popular level discussion. And at this stage, I think we are disappointing some of them. So my next question is the question I asked you before in terms of gender identity. Is it performative? Is it biological? Can you just give us your opinion on that?
Sure, yes, of course. Well, I think often, unfortunately, the whole gender issue has become so ideologically emotional and confrontational and polarized at the moment, which I think is very unhelpful. So to me, I'm a both and person. Okay, so is it biological? Yeah, I'd say of course it is. I'm a biologist. Is it also a social construct? Yes, of course it is. Gender is profoundly and deeply cultural and deeply social. So I'm a both and person in that respect. And I think the problem is sometimes I think in this whole discussion, people are very quick to sort of pull apart, you know, as it were, pull apart the discussions as if they were in some way polarized or opposite. I don't see it in that way at all. But I do think the biology is important. I mean, just looking now at the coronavirus, on average around the world, if you're male, you're twice as likely to die from coronavirus as if you're female. Okay, so that's not a social construct. That's just a fact about your biology. Okay, so we don't even know all the reasons for that yet, but it's just a fact. You know, we had to face up the facts. Okay, we had to face up the fact that we males have a Y chromosome, and mostly the vast majority of females have two X chromosomes and they don't have a Y, and that makes a big difference. Okay, it makes a difference in our hormones and our development. It makes a difference in all kinds of ways. But does that mean that is somehow tells you all about gender? No, of course not. No, for gender you need history, you need psychology, you need your social constructs as well to really understand gender. It's a very complex kind of identity. Is there transgenderism? Yeah, we know that for thousands of years. So I just think the whole discussion is a bit of a both and. You know, that's why I just hope that we don't polarize things in such a way that people who are transgender and who actually, you know, have different views about that themselves sort of get lost in the middle of the ideological discussion. And I think sometimes human needs and aspirations can get lost in the midst of ideology. And I think that's a danger, actually.
It's strange because it might be a little bit opportunistic if you want to take this anomaly. I know this might not be politically correct, but if you think of transgender is definitely not normative. So to then build a whole ideology on something that is very confusing and, like you said, there for thousands of years. And then to now try and nullify any form of gender is just perhaps insincere and opportunistic and like you said not helping even the transgender community who are really wrestling with some deep thoughts. So in terms of there are other questions just asking. I think people want to get in and they want to get in on the audio. So guys, we can do that in a bit. I just want to run through another few questions, and then it can be a dirty free for all in terms of asking questions, and that's when it gets heated, Dennis. So I hope you're ready for that. The next question I just quickly want to run through is this. Should we edit our children's genome? So apparently it's possible. It's happened in China. I mean, you know all about this. And I have sympathy for the potential of maybe editing a genome for preventative measures. But it seems like it's moving in the direction of enhancement. And that opens up just a whole can of ethical worms. So what's your take on it? And should we edit our children's genome?
Yes. Well, just to go to the, as you mentioned, just so everyone knows, the discovery that kind of triggered off this whole big discussion, that was in November 2018 by Dr. Jianqin He. It's spelled H-E, but pronounced He in Mandarin. And so the Chinese guy who genetically modified twins, I think probably only one of the twins actually, the other twin probably didn't get modified properly. But the work hasn't been published. Okay, this is all by his own talks that he gave. He gave a famous talk at Hong Kong University soon after making this discovery. And then, of course, that triggered a huge discussion. So what he did was to remove the gene using CRISPR-Cas technology, this new genetic engineering technology. He removed the gene in these twins. That expresses a particular protein, that expresses a protein that's necessary in some cases of HIV for HIV to infect. Okay, so his aim was to prevent the transmission of HIV from the parents to the children, okay, by giving them this advantage. So in a sense, it was sort of an aim and an enhancement. Okay, so that's what triggered the whole huge discussion. Mm. Right. Okay, so coming then to enhancement, I think a lot depends on what people mean by enhancement. And there are various flavors of enhancement, and that makes the conversation more difficult. I think often when people are talking about enhancement, they are thinking of, I don't know, movies like Avatar or something, you know, where, you know, you've got these genetically engineered superhumans who do amazing things and control avatars in space. You're talking about science fiction very often, I think, when people think about that transhumanist type of enhancement. So clearly that's one form of enhancement, where you're trying to create a race of superhumans who have incredibly high intelligence or are athletically very remarkable or something way beyond the present human capabilities. And we, of course, can come back to transhumanism later. Okay. But then you also have another type of enhancement where basically you are restoring something to somebody, but you're not giving them an advantage over and above the range of abilities that you would find in the human population. And I suppose a typical example there would be, you know, an athlete who has a mobility problem. He's lost his legs and he gets artificial legs and you know, enables him to run very fast, but not faster than other human beings. Okay, so that is that enhancement or is that healing? Okay, so you have a fuzzy boundary beginning to emerge here. Okay. And then there's another type, which is common probably to us, pretty much as all of us, which is, again, a sort of enhancement, or is it? So I'm wearing glasses, okay, so my eyesight is definitely better with them on. So is that healing? A lot of people take statins to try and control their cholesterol levels, so they might not get heart attacks and stroke quite so easily in old age and all that kind of thing. And so is that an enhancement? So there's a kind of a fuzzy boundary as we move from those more dramatic forms of enhancement towards healing. And then when we get to healing, of course, well, you know, we're talking about not just medical healing, but we have psychiatric healing, we have psychological healing, a lot of different types of healing there. Okay. So that gives you a kind of range of spectrum, you know, different types of enhancement. And so I think when we're having a discussion about enhancement, obviously, the discussion will depend on what kind of enhancement we're actually talking about, okay? And I think just to pursue that a little bit further, I personally, you know, I'm all for the use of genetic engineering in medical healing. I think healing is central, certainly central to me as a Christian, central to Jesus and his own ministry on planet Earth. And so healing clearly, to me, is very central. And there are some wonderful, finally, new applications of genetic engineering for the healing of genetic diseases, like sickle cell anemia. There have been a few good cases recently where there have been serious healing based on CRISPR-Cas technology and the repair of the gene that's causing sickle cell anemia. I think it's great. I mean, I'm all for that healing. I think that's a wonderful thing to do. It's still only applicable to a very small percentage of diseases. I have to say that when molecular biology first really came along in the 1960s, when I was at Oxford doing biochemistry, and we all thought, hurrah, you know, in the next few years, all the diseases are going to be cured by molecular biology. It's taken a long time for genetic engineering to really start getting applied to some of these diseases. But it's coming along. It's coming along. I'm quite optimistic now. Mm-hmm. So I think that healing is wonderful. I think it's great application of genetic engineering. That is coming back to your first question then, different from, you know, should we change the genome of like doing the embryo editing? Embryo editing is the name for it. As I mentioned, Dr. He did it in China in November 2018. Well, he's now in prison.
Maybe I can just make it more popular for stupid people like myself. So if you people are talking about editing your genes so that you can be taller, which would be beneficial if you want your kid to be a professional basketball player or something. So it almost becomes absurd, I think, from my perspective, but it becomes very real. And there's a great sci-fi movie called Gattaca. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it asks this question in such a, I think, profound way. So yeah, I'm just putting that out there.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Now, I've watched Gattaca quite a long time ago now. Yes. So I think the thing to remember here, of course, and I think this is where the transhumanist movement is a little bit naive about the genetics, and often they speak without really knowing much about it. So what's become very clear over the past 5 years, especially 10 years, is if you take a complex trait like variation in height. Now, we know that variation in height is 80% heritable in a population, right? In other words, 80% of the variation of that trait that you see in a population can be attributed to the genetic variation in that population, right? Now, the thing is that now we know there are hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of genetic variants that are involved in the variation in height, okay? And the same is true now, going right across behavioral genetics. If you look at something like intelligence, educational attainment, if you look at various psychiatric, if you look at schizophrenia, if you want to go to psychiatry, if you look at weight, having a very high BMI, whatever it is. Okay, so it's very clear now from many, many, many studies that there are hundreds and hundreds of genetic variants that contribute to the variation that you see in the population with respect to those particular traits in the population. And each one only contributes maybe 0.01%. Okay. If you've got thousands of genetic variants, each one contributes this tiny amount. So in other words, what you're really saying is, if I wanted, let's say you want to make an intelligent super race, you want to go to Gattaca, you want to make this super intelligent people. Well, you need to change thousands of genetic variants to actually have any hope of doing that. And by the way, they're all probabilistic. These are all probabilistic variants. So they're not deterministic, okay? So you could come up with a sort of probabilistic formula that if I change these 1,000 genes, that I might have an individual with greater intelligence. But to be honest, that would be doubtful as well. You might just get somebody who's not as intelligent as you thought, because you're talking about a probabilistic kind of statistical variation here. And that's why what people kind of miss in this whole discussion, I think. So Gattaca is kind of interesting and fascinating, and all these other wonderful movies, as sort of thought experiments. They don't really take notice of the reality of our genomes, like our DNA. We've got around 21,500 protein encoding genes in our genome. It's not that many. And to come up with being sure about, sort of more intelligent person, you're talking about probably thousands of variants. Not very realistic to change that. Okay. Yeah. So, in other words, I just want to bring people back to earth on the biology a little bit here. Otherwise, the discussion can easily go off into science fiction very quickly without just facing up to what we are as, what our DNA is really like. So, yeah.
Yeah, Louise says the ultimate classic, if we're talking about movies and books or whatever, is Brave New World of Huxley, I guess. So it's perhaps a better illustration. Okay, guys, the waiting is over. So if you want to ask Dr. Alexander a question, go for it. Let's try and keep it shortish so that he does more answering than us asking. And just maybe put up your hand so that there's some order. And then we can just take questions. I know Pika has been getting a twitch. He wanted to ask something. So maybe just okay, Pika. Just
here go. I am. Okay, you've called me now. Dennis or Professor Alexander, you are a Christian. You're a biologist, and you're at a renowned institution. So you're.
Ooh, can you hear that, Pika? I think you switched yourself off. I heard renowned institution.
It's just Pika. I think he's not aware that he's offline. He'll come back in a moment. I know where he's in Urtuk. There's a bit of signal problems.
Okay. All right, Pika, bad luck. Next up, I'm not sure if you guys have any questions. It can relate to any of the topics or topics that we didn't necessarily address. Feel free to just unmute yourself and go for it.
Hello. So, Herman here. Sorry, I was gone for a while in the middle. So, if this has been asked, I apologize and don't answer it. I'm curious to know what you as a biologist think of the genetic studies related to the genealogical Adam. I know Joshua Swami Das has done some work on that, and William Lane Craig's also working on some things related to using genetics and computational biology to make a case for the historical Adam or some kind of single ancestor or something. I don't have an opinion myself, but I don't know enough about biology to know.
Sure. Yes. So if you look, there are three papers out, at least maybe more now, but there are three papers that if simply based on the genetics that take you back to a population in Africa from whom we are all descending, which has between 9 and 12,000 reproductively active individuals. Okay, so that means that so certainly that doesn't give you a single couple or something like that. Okay, it does give you a very restricted population, and so that's part of that discussion. I know there are people who would like to take it further than that and say, well, there was some couple within that original population who were the sort of, as it were, the Adam and Eve mentioned in Genesis, that kind of argument. I have to say, I'll give my personal opinion. Personally, I don't find that very convincing. I'm not sure why you would need that in particular. I just see, this is a big discussion, obviously, in how you interpret the Adam and Eve of Genesis and so forth, but I don't interpret them so much in genetic terms. I'm not sure it's a theological chapter. It's about theology. So I would see them more, there's a language used by the late John Stott here from London, where he talked about them as being the Homo divinus, the first divine humans, those first humans who really had personal fellowship and knowledge of God. And I would see the Adam and Eve of Genesis much more in those terms, I think, not in genetic terms. I don't think Genesis 1 really has anything to do with genetics. And so that's sort of where I'm coming from, that I think.
So in other words, if there is a genetic Adam and Eve, it is coincidental to the story of Genesis. It's just trying to tell a different story.
I think so. And also, I mean, if you just look at the context of Genesis 1 to 3, I mean, the word Adam is used in three different meanings, even in the first three chapters. So you have Genesis chapter 1, where clearly it's humankind. God creates humankind in Genesis chapter 1. Male and female, he created them, plural. Some English translations now translate Adam as humankind. Clearly that's what it means in that context. If you go to Genesis 2, a little bit into Genesis 3, then you suddenly find a definite article in front of Adam. You find the Adam, the Adam. It's mentioned about more than 20 times in that chapter. Okay, so, and the definite article is not used in front of personal names in Hebrew. Okay, so not a personal name. Okay, it's making probably some different kind of point. This is where the idea of Adam as a kind of federal head of humankind comes in, I think, when Paul picks that up in Romans chapter 5 in the New Testament. So you have the Adam, and then suddenly in Genesis, where are we now? Genesis chapter 4. You get the Adam, the definite article disappears, and then you have Adam as marrying Eve and having a lot of kids, okay? So definitely having sex and having reproduction and being a real person. So there's a lot of interesting theology going on, even packed into those first few chapters of Genesis, I think, that needs a bit of unwrapping. That's where I want to start, and say, well, wait a minute, what's all that about? What's going on here? Clearly the evidence, I mean, the emphasis is really not, it's on theology, I think. It's on theology. And so I personally don't get hung up on the genetics.
Interesting. Pika, you want to try again?
Hello. I am so sorry and embarrassed about what happened there, but I'm back. I don't know how far I got, but what I was saying was, Professor Alexander, you are a biologist at a renowned institution, yet you're also a Christian. And I often hear staunch creationists making claims that the scientific community is unfairly biased against any research or scientists that make an argument for intelligent design or creation or Noah's flood or whatever it is. Yet that also sounds a lot like stories I've heard bad engineers say. They're just bad engineers, so they rationalize why the engineering community doesn't laud them. Can you speak to this? Have you seen any such discrimination or ostracization, or do you think we can safely ignore claims like that?
Well, I think the claim it depends how you present the claim exactly. You presented it nicely, I think. I mean, clearly, you know, the biological research community around the world, including here in Cambridge, takes the Darwinian evolution as being the paradigm within which all of our research and medicine is carried out, basically. Now, of course, the great discussions about mechanisms and so forth and so on. But I mean, basically, so, you know, that's the map we use, the theory we use that is just in use every day of our research lives, right? So when it comes then to creationists or intelligent design people, I think probably the thing I would say there is, well, if they're able to publish in a really good journal, if they're able to publish something, get it into Nature, in such a way that it would subvert or undermine in some way, let's say, the Darwinian theory, then of course they would be famous and they would be, and quite rightly so, you know, everyone has a great longing to publish something that would really upset, you know, some famous theory. That's a dream. Often a false dream, but a dream that many scientists have. Of course, now you might want to say, well, that would never get published because of the prejudice that's mentioned there by folk from the intelligent design movement and so on. I personally don't see that. I mean, I had actually one of the leaders of intelligent design who now runs their lab over in Seattle in Washington State in the States. He was in my lab for several years. Actually, I gave him space. He needed some space. I happened to know him, and, you know, he just got on with his work. That was fine. And he published some good articles. But it all then comes down to interpretation. You know, it comes to how do you interpret the data that are coming out there? And I think that's where it gets a little bit tricky. Okay, so, yeah. So, I don't know. I'm trying to steer a bit of a middle way here, I think, trying to be fair to everybody.
I have no idea what this question means. It's from Simon. Simon, maybe you can unmute yourself, because he's just asking the question, what does Dr. Alexander think of Crick's directed panspermia?
Yeah, so my question, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
My question to you, Dr. Alexander, is what do you make of Francis Crick's theory of directed panspermia? The guy who got the Nobel Prize for the discovery of DNA. Why would somebody like that with those worldview kind of commitments be punting towards something like that?
And maybe just help us, what on earth we mean by...
I'll explain panspermia. So panspermia is the idea that the origin of life started by life coming from other planets, or was carried on a meteorite, or carried in some way to Earth. Okay. And part of that sort of drive, panspermia kind of, it comes and goes in the scientific community.
Sorry, I just want to make sure. And that undermines evolution, am I right?
No, it doesn't undermine evolution, but I don't think so, because all it's saying is, well, life began somewhere by evolution, someplace, maybe on Mars. Okay, Mars was the early life of Mars. That's why there's a lot of interest in Mars, because the early planetary life of Mars seemed to have water and seemed to have potential for life. It's not that far away in cosmological terms anyway. And so could life have come from there or something? Coming back to Francis Crick, it's fascinating, as you say, why he would go in that particular direction. But then, of course, panspermia is not totally out of the question now. I mean, you know, people still keep open to that idea. And I think the huge search for life in other planets, mostly driven by NASA and so forth, is partly there, you know, that if there is life in other planets not too far away, which is quite likely, I think as a biochemist, I'd be really surprised if there isn't life in some other planets, then, well, could it not be, you know, that that some bit of that, you know, the bit of the that planet was able in some form to get into the atmosphere of Earth and so on. the big experiments, actually, there was a famous experiment several years ago. I think it was done by an Australian, where they packed a whole rock, you know, just full of bacteria. And they it sounds like a great fun experiment. They blasted it at a great speed against some concrete wall. And then they just, you know, they try to mimic what would happen when a meteorite is hitting the Earth. And when it comes down, obviously, a great big explosion of light and friction and heat and so forth. Anyway, and then they looked for the bacteria, and lo and behold, some were still living afterwards. They could still culture them. You know, and they, you know, again, this sort of takes the view, well, it's not impossible, you know, that a meteorite can actually bring life from another planet. So, but why Francis Crick himself really went that direction, I don't know. It's interesting. I think partly it's that life began here so quickly in terms of geological terms, you know. I mean, by 3.8 billion years ago, there's reasonable evidence for life. Certainly by 3.5 billion years ago, evidence for life is pretty clear on this planet. So, and still by 4 billion years, you've still got asteroid bombardment going on. And so, you know, it happened pretty quick. And I think that's part of the driver for panspermia. It sort of pushes you, gets you some more time into the system so you can go elsewhere you know, and look around for life in some other planet. Maybe it came from there. They had more time on that planet, maybe, you know, to get life going. That's the sort of driver for that, I think.
Okay. Isaac, you have a question?
Yes, so, Professor, you spoke a little bit about the mind and how it supervenes on the brain, and so implying a dualist view of man where we have a non-physical component. And I think that's probably orthodoxy for Christians. We speak about a soul, and, you know, I guess we can have slightly varying definitions of it, but I think, you know, mind and soul would be, you know, more or less the same thing, or maybe mind would be a component of the soul. So I want to ask you, what would you say are the necessary conditions for a soul to exist or to arise? And what are the implications based on that for genetic engineering and the capacity for man to effectively mess with souls?
Thank you. Well, first of all, I think the language of dualism needs careful definition, as you well know, I'm sure. And I personally don't call myself a dualist. I wouldn't see myself as a dualist. I think someone who believes in simply the language of mind and the language of brain is not necessarily a dualist in the traditional sense of believing the mind is some non-physical entity. I certainly don't believe the mind is a non-physical entity, depending on how, again, you define that. So in genes, determinism, and God, I wanted to come up with a language, but I just came up with an acronym that's a bit of a mouthful, and I apologize to everyone for it, but the acronym is DAME, D-A-M-E, the dual aspect monistic emergentism, okay, was the sort of position I'm trying to put forward here. And it's a bit of a middle road position, okay, it's saying, yeah, mind is definitely a distinct entity from brain. It's not the same as brain. We can't identify with brain, okay. We need a whole different language to experience and describe mind, okay. And it's emergent, so that I want to get that in there. And there are different aspects of it. It's not a different, okay. And then you get into the language of substance and exactly what we mean by that. It's very tricky to steer a middle way in this discussion, I think. And I think that's part of why always, I mean, no two philosophers are ever going to agree precisely on the brain-mind distinction. I think, you know, that you always find this great range of views. It's partly, I think, a language game. It's partly a language problem that we have, actually. So I think you can talk about the mind as being a very distinct entity without which we wouldn't be having this conversation, clearly, because we are using our minds. Therefore, it has a very, has an ontological reality in that sense. But that doesn't mean to say that it is non-physical. Why would it be non-physical? No, if it's supervening upon the brain, it's absolutely emergent from the brain. So it's not a non-physical entity, but it's simply that we use a different kind of language in order to try and get our heads around it. Just let me just give you one little illustration I sometimes use, which may or may not help, I don't know. But I mean, I just think of a computer working out you know, a mathematical, let's say we give a computer a statistical challenge to give us some statistical significance of a particular set of data. Okay, so I pump in my data into the computer. Now, I could analyze the computer at the physical level. Of course, I could, in principle, you know, tell you all about the trillions of electrons flowing around each different circuit, et cetera, et cetera. If I do that, and if that is the limit of my description, I certainly am not going to be able to tell you about statistics. I'm not going to be able to tell you about the mathematical challenge. That has its own reality. That has its own distinctive category of language and understanding. Okay. It's obviously complementary. It supervenes upon the trillions of electrons flowing around that computing system. But it is, so it's not non-physical. It's entirely supervening upon, but it's distinctive. Right? To me, that just gives a little bit of a feel for how, when we're talking about mind and brain, maybe that might help us in thinking about that relationship. But it's tricky. It's kept philosophers going for centuries, okay? So, I'm sure that we have some more work to do on that.
There's, as you've got two more questions here, from Peter Ein and Herman, but I just want to give somebody an opportunity from YouTube, Kala Hatteng, who's asking this question. It sounds like from your answer about ID, intelligent design, like you don't hold to Kuhn's idea. I think she's referring to Thomas Kuhn's idea of scientific revolutions and the resistance to paradigm shifts. Can you clarify how you see the progress of science? I'm not sure if you're familiar with Thomas Kuhn and what she's referring to.
Yes, Thomas Kuhn, yes, scientific revolution, indeed. So, well, I mean, this is a huge discussion, clearly. I suppose, like all my scientific colleagues, I see science as hypothesis-driven. I do see the aim of science is to falsify our pet theories. That's not the only aim, clearly. The bigger aim, maybe, is to come up with theories that will encompass our data and make more sense of it, to make it more coherent and so forth. Part of the reason I don't personally believe in intelligent design with a big I and big D, by the way, big I, big D, that I don't go in that direction because I just don't think it does justice to the way we normally do science. I mean, I think, well, I mean, there are a number of reasons I don't really take an ID position myself. I just think that saying that we haven't been able to understand fully how the complexity of the first cell comes into being, or whatever particular argument we want to use. Therefore, there's a gap in our scientific knowledge. Therefore, a designer is somehow, or design is therefore the inference, the best explanation. To me, that's not really a scientific way of doing things. I think if you have a gap in your knowledge, you just, you know, you keep working. And if we think about the huge gaps in the knowledge of people in the past centuries, the huge gap that Darwin had in his knowledge of genetics, because he didn't know about genetics at all. And so, I mean, it's very easy to find up gaps in scientific knowledge, and that's what keeps us going in science. That's what helps us to write our next grounds and to do more research. So our goal is to fill up the gaps. So simply pointing out a gap and then saying, oh, you know, therefore it's design, I just think doesn't really help us in the advance of science. I call it designer of the gaps, the designer of the gaps argument. I don't think it's helpful myself. I don't know if that's at all useful in terms of thinking about that particular issue. But
I think you have quite a few ID proponents hanging around here, so I guess I can push back a little bit. I just want to look at what Herman, well, I first just look at what Piet Hein said. He asked the question, do you think that life could spontaneously have emerged on the basis of biochemical processes alone? I know we're jumping around, Dennis, but you... you're the guy with the CV, so you're supposed to cope with all of this. So do you think that life could spontaneously have emerged on the basis of biochemical processes alone, or would it need, in your opinion, a divine spark, as it were?
Right. So I would take the form of view, but with a theological explanation at the same time. So theologically, as I was saying earlier, what I see in the Bible, I believe in the Bible, I believe in what the Bible says about God as creator. And clearly what the Bible says to me about God as creator is that he is intimately involved in every aspect of the created order. And we see that right throughout the Old Testament. We read Psalm 104. We read the wonderful passages about the imminence of Christ in the created order in John 1, Colossians 1, Hebrews 1, anything, first chapter of any book you like, okay? This is where we read about the imminence of Christ in the created order. In Christ, all things exist, right? So in other words, the Bible sees God as the intimate author of all that happens in the created order, all the physical material things that happen, right? And that, I think, is very important. So in other words, do I then see a possible biochemical description of the origin of life in principle? Yeah, I don't see why not. There have been some really remarkable advances in that field over the past 20 years, I have to say. Are we there yet? No, we're not there yet by miles. And so it's a bit like a jigsaw puzzle right now, biochemically speaking, where you have lots of the pieces, but we just don't know how they all fit together. But there's some very interesting theories. There's some very interesting theories about the origins of the genetic code, for example, and so forth and so on, you know. So in other words, the divine spark in terms of, you know, some miracle happened, you know, a particular miracle. I don't see the Bible going in that direction myself. I just see God speaks and things happen. And it's our job as scientists is to try and understand what happens when God speaks, basically.
Dennis, are you, it's 8 o'clock now. Are you okay to still go on for a bit?
Sure, I'm happy. Yeah. I'm in lockdown, you know, I got all the time in the world.
So I just want to read this question. This was an SMS to me by Tani Christine, who's in our congregation. She asks, what is your view on survival of the fittest, which involves pain and death as a method used by a loving God?
Sure. Well, that's another huge question, obviously.
This is very unfair. Yeah. You agreed to do this.
Many books have been written about and clearly. So in terms of survival of the fittest, I mean, that was actually, by the way, that phrase did not come from Charles Darwin. It came from Herbert Spencer, who was a philosopher at the time of Darwin and who tried to popularize Darwinism, not very helpfully a lot of the time. But anyway, Darwin did take over the language of the survival of the fittest. The language, mostly we Darwinians generally use the language of reproductive success as being closer to what we believe is going on. In other words, so when you have a variant genome, it gets tested out in the workshop of life, if you like. In other words, that variant genome generates a lion which has 10 cubs. They're all variant, will have slightly variant genomes, and one or two of them are just a little bit, give that lion cub a little bit faster, and the lion can run a little bit faster and bite a bit, you know, more strongly and eat more quickly and just pass as more likely to pass on its genes to the next generation, right? That's reproductive success. How many sets of variant genes are there that get passed on through succeeding generations? Okay, right. So clearly that involves death, suffering. 99% of all the species that ever lived have died, gone extinct, and so forth and so on. So how do we go about that? And in the light of God, as of a God, believing in a God of love, well, clearly, okay, I could give you a one-hour sermon. I'm just going to get this down really, really short. But let me just mention that in a book I wrote called Creation or Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? Some years ago, there is a chapter about that. In a book I published, where are we now? A book I published in 2018 called Is There Purpose in Biology? I have a very similar chapter in there on this question. So just in case we run out of time here. So basically where I go with that is, well, let's think about, you know, how many ways could there be to generate a universe in which there are freely willed, intelligent human beings who have the potential for fellowship with God? That is to say, they have the capacities that we have. They have the ability to pray, they have free will, they have the ability to make moral choices, and so forth. Okay, how would you go about doing that? Of course, we're not God, so we don't know the answer to that question, okay? But what we can say is when we look around the universe, looks like the chemistry and the biochemistry of the universe looks similar in every direction that we look. We can look a very long way, and we can look at a lot of carbon compounds out there in space, and there are billions and trillions of them. A lot of carbon up there. So it's very likely that life is going to be carbon-based life. There are very good biochemical reasons for that. Whenever we get to that planet, that wonderful planet that's going to have life there. Okay, so, and then we have to think, well, if carbon-based life is God's chosen way in which we and all other living things come into being, then what we have is sort of a package deal here. Can we have a package deal? And you can think of every nasty thing that we don't like. Okay, coronaviruses, no, we don't like those. They kill us. We do not like pain. No, we don't like that. Okay, we don't like cancer. Definitely not. And so forth. You make a great list. Then on the other side of your big table, make a mental table in your head. On the other side of the table, you can add up all the benefits of those particular facets that without which we wouldn't have cancer, we wouldn't have coronavirus and so forth. Okay. In other words, even eating food will, as it's digested, give you free oxygen radicals that tend to increase your mutation rate. So should you not eat food? Well, I think we all agree we should eat food, but, you know, and if you eat too much food, you'll get ill and so forth and so on. And some of our genes actually come, some of our good genes that we need in our bodies actually come from viruses. Okay, so viruses, of which there are trillions and trillions and trillions on planet Earth, have contributed some of the genes involved in our own evolution. Okay, and so forth. So, and pain, well, yeah, but you know, pain, we need pain. We wouldn't be alive without pain. And you look at poor patients with Hansen's disease or leprosy, and some people call it then, you know, that the reason they have so many problems is because of the destruction of their pain receptors. And that's why they often face these terrible problems that they do. Now, thankfully, we have therapy. So in other words, you can go on with this great big table. Okay, where am I getting to on that? Well, in other words, is this the only way in which we can come into being? Is that a possibility? I think simply asking that question is a kind of theodicy. It gives us a sort of handle on what's going on here. In other words, our existence is very costly. Okay, it's very clear that's the case. We have a very costly existence. We, humanity, now have a costly existence that goes back millions of years. And so very costly things, very precious. We know that, of course, from South Africa, your diamonds, you know, you have to go a long way down to get those compressed rocks that make beautiful diamonds. Okay, so a lot of pressure there. Okay. And taking that,
then the Brits come and take them for yourselves. That's
right. Well, that comes into the story as well. But you know what? It just, to me, it sort of speaks of the pressure that's been involved, biologically speaking, in terms of evolutionary history of us being here on planet Earth is unbelievably high. It's unbelievably high. And that means that we are very precious. We're very valuable. God has a special value and places on us a particular value in that way. Now, of course, then you have to add on a very important point to the whole story that clearly for Christians, this is phase one. We're in phase one, getting ready for phase two. Phase one is the place we get ready. And so God has designed this particular planet in such a way that we would have carbon-based life, but in us, in such a way that it gives the opportunity to get ready for the next phase, where there will be no more death, no more pain, no more crying, which many of us, of course, are greatly looking forward to. But right now we're in phase one, okay? And that is the challenge we have.
Okay. I just want to run through Herman's question here. Again, on a completely different topic and no pressure. What is your opinion of animal self-consciousness? In some conservative Christian circles, animals have been dismissed, not given much credit in terms of their minds, but more evidence is being found of abstract thinking and the capacity for emotion and self-consciousness. What is your view on the capacities of animals and how that might inform how Christians think about animals?
Well, no, that's a fascinating question, I think. And I think one thing about animals, well, first, let me just make a couple of points here. First of all, we really don't know exactly how conscious animals are, simply because we only know about our own consciousness. I, in fact, cannot prove your consciousness. I can't prove it systematically. I infer it based upon your own behavior, the fact that, as far as I can see, we're all part of the same species. And given that you're experiencing language and something that I'm experiencing, therefore I infer that you have a mind, I infer you have consciousness. Okay. Now, when I look at my cat, I can also do that. But I really don't know. I don't know how, you know, I would certainly say that animals have their own form of consciousness. And I'm choosing my words carefully here. So there is such a thing as a dog consciousness, a cat consciousness, a kangaroo consciousness, and on we can go, particularly for those animals that have extensive, you know, neuronal systems and have complex neuronal systems. And you can go down and down and down until you get, do cockroaches have consciousness? I don't think so. But in other words, where would you draw the line? I have no idea. But simply thinking about primates or, you know, animals with higher brain functions, I'm certainly didn't have consciousness. They behave in such a way that I would say, but it's not mine. It's not human. How could it possibly be? They don't have human nutrition. They don't have human behavior. They have different behaviors. And so surely they have a different consciousness, which is valuable and precious to them and important, but it's not mine. And I think that's where I would make the key point here. And so in evolutionary terms, this is what you expect. You expect something as profound as human consciousness to have a slow and gradual history. And that's exactly what we see out there in the animal kingdom. We see a gradual emergence again of consciousness from brain. We come back, of course, to brain and minds and so forth. So that's the sort of direction I would go on that. And yeah, I certainly don't agree with people who deny any form of consciousness to animals. I'm just not sure what that would be based on or why you want to do that. I don't know.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? I see Louise has got some very technical questions, and I just want to leave them if I can. If we have any other questions, then just unmute yourself and quickly ask a question. Otherwise, we can go to Louise and wrap up for tonight.
All right. I have another question. My question is simply this, that someone like Stephen Hawking has made some statements about, he's even, I think, written an article about determinism, etc. And a rebuttal that many people have had of it is that Stephen Hawking is a great physicist, but he's not a philosopher. And then, you know, the same might be said for philosophers. So it's an interesting question to me. Who would you say, is there even anybody who is in a good position to answer questions on determinism, such profound things on agency? Would you say biologists are, for example, in a stronger position than philosophers, than physicists, or is everybody about the same?
Right. Yes. So thinking about the late Stephen Hawking, you're right that his great friend, Lord Martin Rees here in Cambridge, once remarked, Stephen Hawking was obviously someone he knew very well, but he said, dear Stephen has never read a philosophy book in his life. And I think probably that's true. It just wasn't his field. And so what tends to happen, and this happens a lot in science, and I can be guilty of it as well, so I confess guilt. But, you know, if somebody then, especially if they become famous like Stephen Hawking, or if they get a Nobel Prize, and suddenly they're thrust into the limelight, and so then they asked, no one expects them to know, be able to answer questions about anything. Okay. And of course, that is a danger. And I'm shuddering even saying this because of trying to answer questions across such a wide range of topics. And I think there's always a risk in doing that. And that's why I always like to recommend books by philosophers or other people who are specialists in their field. So as far as the general question of, is any particular discipline in a stronger position? Well, I do think philosophers are in a much stronger position in terms of helping us with understanding the terms we use, with the definitions, the language we use. That's a speciality. And I'm going to come back to Christian List, professor of philosophy at London School of Economics. I hope you'll read his book, Why is Free Will Real? I think it's a great book. It's quite accessible. And it's not very long, but it's published by a very good press. And I think it's a very good book. And I value those philosophers, and there are many others I could speak of who speak to the free will question. Alfred Mealy, by the way, would be another one from the States, and there are many others who I think help us a huge amount in this whole discussion. And a lot of what I say is just comes from my reading of these, and you know, it's secondary. It's just I'm using the literature really to help my own understanding. But I think biologists, therefore, may be able to bring something rather different to the table, because, of course, we see the brain in biological terms as well, and mechanical, physical terms, and so that enables us to maybe talk to people like Sam Harris with some, you know, the same language and the same sympathy, even if we end up in different places. So I think there's a lot of disciplines that contribute in different ways, and clearly AI and computing has a big contribution to make here. I think when quantum computing finally comes along, I think that's going to make a big contribution to the whole field of consciousness, because finally we'll be able to model various, you know, neuronal pathways, neuronal structures in a way that we simply cannot with present computers, though that's really slow actually to get around it. Quantum computing will help. So I think every, you know, different fields can make different contributions to this, these really sort of big questions.
Dennis, I want to wrap up something that you told me yesterday on our phone call. You said that it's interesting that in the scientific community, you find, the scientific community in Cambridge, and you've worked at many other universities, you are discovering a lot of Christians in that community. And it's interesting, if you compare that to the humanities, it seems like you've got more Christians hanging out at scientific departments than at the humanity departments. Maybe you can just comment a little bit on that, and maybe just share something of your own journey as we wrap up, how you as a biologist, as a scientist, also happens to be a deeply committed Christian. Maybe you can just share a little bit on that.
Yeah, just on the first point, I think it is interesting. I mean, certainly if you look around Cambridge and the different departments, and the same is true at Oxford, certainly another university I know very well, what you find is that if you want to find Christians in the different academic departments and the faculty, I'm talking about faculty now, I think it's much more likely in science departments. It's quite easy to do that in the science departments. So loads of Christians around. If you go to humanities, you will also find Christians, but just less. You're going to have a harder time. And so, of course, and the same is definitely true in Oxford. If you go to the physics department in Oxford, I can think of 8, 10 professors of physics, 4 professors of physics who are very committed Christians in Oxford, who write books about science, religion, and who talk about it, give talks and all kinds of things. Okay, so yeah, so, you know, it's just quite interesting, I think. Now, you might ask the question why that is the case. And maybe that's related to your second question. So I actually became a Christian when I was 13, just a new teenager. And so when I started getting interested in biology, obviously in the latter years at school, and then got into Oxford and went to study biochemistry, I was already a Christian, therefore I really wanted to relate my faith to my science. It's a natural thing to do. For me, as a Christian, I've never wanted to live in some kind of split, you know, brain where somehow I have a religious brain on Sunday and then go and do my science the rest of the week as a separate activity. I've never thought that's a very healthy thing. I always wanted to bring them together. And as a Christian, I believe in the Lordship of Christ. That is, Christ is Lord over every aspect of our lives, and I want to make sure Christ is Lord over my science. So I've always been interested, therefore, in science and faith, how we relate them, and always had really the privilege of being able to listen to people, very committed Christians who are very fine scientists of an earlier generation from my own, people like Donald Mackay, thinking of brain and mind. I mean, Donald Mackay was very influential in my own thinking. He was professor of neuroscience, or what was called then in those days, professor of communications at Keele University. I would say one of the brightest minds in the science religion field in this country, certainly in the latter half of the 20th century. And he was somebody who could publish in Nature on the neuroscience field and publish in the philosophy journal Mind in the same year. Actually, he did that, and that's pretty rare. That's pretty rare. We were speaking earlier about people, you know, who could really contribute strongly from both fields, and he certainly could. So I have a lot of time. Unfortunately, he was a guy who used to come to Oxford when I was there, and I remember giving him a couple of talks, and he was very, very persuasive and so forth. So I suppose I've been privileged by growing up with people around who have gone before and who are very strong in this field. My own tutor in Oxford, actually, Arthur Peacock, was my own tutor of biochemistry. And later on, not then so much, but a little bit later on, he became ordained in the Church of England and ended up becoming quite well known, actually, in the science religion field. Theologically, we weren't exactly on the same page, but we were in quite a lot of things. And yeah, so I benefited also from his writings and his thinking, and many others as well, many others. So I think we've been privileged here in the UK, especially maybe, to just have a lot of Christians who are top of the scientific field in their own disciplines, but also who are serious about their faith and really want to relate it. And Science of Christian Belief, a journal that I edited for many years, you know, would have plenty of articles coming in from many people who wanted to think more clearly on these particular issues. And I think that also has been very helpful.
Dennis, thank you so much. Maybe you've spoken a bit about Christian List. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Yes. His book on why free will is real. Maybe before we let you go, just maybe punt one or two titles that you think will be helpful on some of the topics that we suggested. I know it's not fun to talk about your own books, but maybe just repeat them again, some of the books' titles that you think is relevant.
Okay, so I can mention my own books. I've got, as I mentioned, Are We Slaves to Our Genes, coming out later this year with Cambridge University Press. And that is a popular version of my Gifford lectures, actually. Mm. Hopefully popular. Popular in the Cambridge University Press sense of the word. But no, really, I think it should be readable for anybody who's not in the genetics field. And I have a whole chapter at the beginning just explaining the genetics for anyone who doesn't have much genetics in their background. So hopefully that would be helpful for people. The 2018 book I mentioned, Is There Purpose in Biology? Addresses the question, which we sort of touched on a little bit tonight, but not much. So a lot of scientists say, well, you know, when you look at evolutionary biology, obviously it could have gone any way that it could have gone any which way. It's not necessary that we should be here. We're just a big accident, and it could have gone other ways. And so there can be no purpose, really, in biological explanations, because they don't really lead us in that direction. They lead us to the sense of a purposeless planet, purposeless universe. And so that book is just challenging that idea. You say, oh, let's look at that one, okay? And then 2017... yes, Genes, Determinism and God is the more serious academic work arising out of the Gifford lectures. So it would probably, I mean, it's a book better for people who have some genetics background or whatever, I think. And a book that we have touched on that had its second edition in 2014, Creation or Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? ? So that came out, second edition, 2014. And it's published by Lion Publishing. Actually, okay, it's published by Monarch Press in Oxford. Monarch Press is one of the presses of Lion Publishing in Oxford. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those are those books. As far as the other book, oh, my word, I could go on a lot. And I just would, I mean, I could give you plenty of titles and authors of people in free will that have been helpful to me, but I'm just thinking, I'm wondering if I could do that by email. I'm just worried about getting some of the titles wrong. Alfred Mealy, M-E-L-E, is certainly somebody worth reading a lot in the free will field. He's been running a huge, great collaboration on the free will discussion. There's a guy, yeah, so... But I could give you a whole list that I
maybe don't.
Yeah, I think maybe you can circulate it around. Maybe if that, I think that would be better actually. Because
I mean, if we just stick with the, I don't think the lockdown is long enough to just deal with the titles you've already given us. So let's just stick with that for now. Dr. Alexander, thank you so much for visiting us virtually here in South Africa, and you've got an open invitation from a bunch of SAFIS to come and visit us here in the so-called third world, and to return to the country that you once colonized, and we will keep you busy with many more questions. So thank you again.
Thank you. Very good questions. Thank you for the great questions.
I really appreciate it. And we can maybe do a follow-up depending on how long the lockdown is and how up for it you are. But we can maybe have a follow-up. I'm sure people will be very interested in that. Cool. Professor Alexander, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much. Goodbye to all. Thank you.
Well, mate.
Thank you.